Hello, young lovers, whoever you are, I hope your troubles are few. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I've been in love like you. You be brave, young lovers, and follow your star. Brave and faithful and true. And cling very close to each other tonight. I've been in love like you. And I know how it feels to have wings on your heels and to fly down the street in a trance. You fly down that street on the chance that you'll meet, and you meet, not by chance. Don't cry, young lovers, whatever you do. Say don't cry because I'm alone. All my good wishes go with you tonight. I have had a love of my own. And I know how it feels to have wings on your
feet. I'm Michael Ray Dresser, and you're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. And each night we'll bring you the best and the brightest, authors and experts with solutions, the topics you want to hear, and the people who know to bring them to you. So let's do it together. Let's get to the heart of the issues that face us every day, right here, right now on Dresser After Dark, coast to coast, and around the world on the BBS Radio Network.
I've had a love of my own like yours. I have had a love of my own.
Attorney Michael Hohmeier back with us. Michael, how are you?
I'm great, Michael Ray. Thank you. How are you?
Oh, I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for being here. You know, there's so many things going on right now that I'm almost afraid to open up the news. Let me tell you what I woke up to this morning. There were three. You got to love this one. There were three kids, teenagers, who have been charged sexual. What is it when you get charged for sexual whatever and they put it on your record for the rest of your life?
Sex offender.
Sex offender. Yes, I knew that word, offender.
Yes.
All right. Anyways, they got charged as sex offender. It'll be offenders. It'll be on the their record for the rest of their lives. And let me tell you what they did. Are you ready for this?
Uh-oh.
They mooned their friends.
You know, it's all part and parcel of the same mentality that says if a kid brings an aspirin to school, he's a drug pusher, and if he has a toothpick, he's carrying a knife, and he's going to be suspended for a week. This is ridiculous. We've got serious problems facing this country, and I don't think people really have any patience anymore for this kind of idiocy. It's just idiocy. It's gone beyond silliness. It's idiocy. And we've talked previously about the slippery slope and how these small little things lead to worse transgressions down the road. This is the kind of mentality that says, you know, we're basically going to take away all your freedoms and all your decision-making ability, invest it in your betters. I resent that.
No, absolutely. And I think the problem with this is the being accused is one thing, being charged is another thing, but these kids are going to take this for the rest of their life. They will be sex offenders, and they're going to have to be registered, and no matter where they go, it's going to be on the record.
And that's not what the desire to improve the sex offense laws was in. This is not what it was intended to do. This is not the reason that we've tried to beef up the laws. This is beyond silly. It's idiocy. It's sheer idiocy. We don't have time for this kind of idiocy, and the people who are pushing it need to be punished politically. They need to be removed from office. If they're not elected officials directly, then the administrative agencies need to be corralled so that the people under their wing are held accountable and stopped from doing this kind of stupidity.
I'm going to give you a projection. Here's the projection. We have the Casey Anthony trial that was just over with. By the way, their attorneys are charging the state of Florida for $150,000 in attorney's fees, and the taxpayers are going to have to pay that. But you got the Casey Anthony thing. You go back through all of these major, major lawsuits and court trials that have taken forever, and they get to walk. And what's going on now are people are getting less and less comfortable with the way that the court system, the justice system, is going to this stage of the game. So what do? If you dump it, what's left? You've got maybe somebody that's going to come in and tell everybody exactly what to do and how to do it. Michael, the writing's on the wall. You take a look at what's going on every day in this country. We just found billions of dollars that went to Afghanistan that went to the Taliban. You find all of those weapons that were the Justice Department is hiding the reason for that got into the drug cartel's hands, kill some of our own people, border guards. What's going on is we are getting such divisions going on right now that unless somebody takes charge here, it's not going to come back. We are so divided. Every time we turn around, there's a division going on.
Yes, unfortunately, the government has preferred to split the opposition by divide and conquer, and it is a minority administration with a minority of support in almost all of the polling. The only way they can accomplish anything is by pitting different sectors of Americans against each other. You know, by saying we're going to raise taxes, but not on you, but only on your neighbor down the street, you know, they're pitting Americans against each other. By saying that certain people get benefits, but not you, only your neighbor down the street, you're pitting other Americans against other Americans. It's the way the administration and its supporters in the Congress work. I think it's really disliked by a huge number of the citizenry. Unfortunately, there are an awful lot of people who aren't paying into the system, who are doing nothing but receiving benefits from it, and that is a important portion of our system that we need to correct. If we don't correct it, as people have wisely predicted, but sadly predicted, any time you get to the point where you've got more people who are getting benefits out of a system than they are paying for those benefits, those folks are going to take away the property rights of others, and the whole system will then collapse. We've got to make sure we don't get that far.
Sure. And then we've got elected officials like Sheila Jackson Lee making comments that basically that the only reason that Obama's having problems is because, you know, he's not Caucasian, yada, yada, and this list goes on. I think the problem with that, that's more division, that's intentional. Somebody gets hurt, some kid who gets attacked, who gets mugged, who gets killed, is going to be the victim of comments like that. If you get enough people, if you get enough people listening to people who say, it's their fault, it's their fault, it's their fault, pretty soon you've got groups of people that are going to get quote-unquote revenge. They're going to make it even, and somebody's going to get hurt in the process, and they've got to know what they're doing.
Yes, you have to believe that they do. It's impossible to sit in a church for 20 years and say, I didn't hear the anti-American, anti-capitalism, anti-Western philosophy screed that was being pushed at that place. And for, you know, shame on us, those of us who bought into a lot of this pablum that was sent to us during the election. But now we all know better. And the question is, are enough people who realize they were sold a bill of goods at best and at worst blinded themselves because they thought this was an historic opportunity to, I don't know, correct an historical wrong or take a stand against racism or for whatever reason they voted the way that they did. They have an opportunity to correct that next year. Hopefully enough people will take that step along with all of those who saw much of what they thought would be coming and has come out of this administration over the last 2.5 years. If there aren't enough of those folks who stand up and present themselves next year, we're going to be going over that cliff that we've been talking about, and it won't take long either.
Now, Michael, my biggest concern with this is I know some very sophisticated people, people that have common sense, there's no question about this, that at the same time think that the president is the most wonderful thing that ever happened. They'll say, oh, I made a few mistakes, but all in all, he's doing good. You wake up in the morning and you get Nancy Pelosi on TV and she says, well, this president has been responsible for more jobs since he's taken office. We know that this is not so, but the rhetoric that goes on, I think the biggest insult is that if you can lie to me, and it's a lie, if you can lie to me and think that whatever you say is okay because you're who you are, then we have another major problem. So the entire political culture today, that ideology that runs the country, that is steeped in I am better than you and class warfare, and underneath it there's got to be that same theme, that theme of let's destroy what's here and replace it with what we want.
The difference in our society today that addresses what you're talking about is the fact that there is an alternative media. Nobody has an excuse now to say, oh, I didn't know that former Speaker Pelosi lied to me this morning. 20 years ago, when there was only one voice in town, and it was the established mainstream media. We know better now. There are alternative media sources, such as your own, talk radio, the internet, blogging. We know, because people will put that information out there, that what got said this morning by this big politician was patently false. I mean, out and out false, and knowingly false, too, which makes it, in my definition, a lie. Let's call it what it is. Nowadays, people don't have an excuse unless they are ostriches, they stick their heads in the sand, or they're committed to believing these people because they want them to succeed with their political goals of overturning our society and our system. People know better now. We know that someone like you will say, I'm calling her on it. This is an abject lie. That means we have a chance today, seeing things for what they really are, to choose to go in a different direction. Hopefully enough of us will, but there is that opportunity today where we see things for what they really are, because it's not the only voice in town, the one coming from the administration, that now we know better. What are we going to choose? What are we all going to choose next year? It's going to come down to us, and frankly, our system will stand or fall based on what all of us do.
You know, I'd be absolutely shocked if he stayed in office, because that would give us the indication that this is the way that the majority of the people in this country want the country run. Now, the Tea Party stood up. We saw what happened last November, and we want to see it again for the 2012 elections. But there are things that are going on now that, you know, people in holding public office, they talk the talk, Michael. They do not walk the walk. Look at the money these people are making. They're worried about somebody else in poverty. How could they make that kind of money and say what they say? If you go back and you take a look at what Obama was in 2008, I think his income was 300 and some odd thousand. It's over 4 million today. And that doesn't count anything else that's coming in. So really, when you take a look at it, you're talking about people that the country isn't, you know, the country has got problems. The country doesn't have jobs. The country doesn't have this. They're living the good life. 71 times the man has played golf. How many times has he used a private jet for personal means? And we're talking about taxing the guy who owns the corporate jet. That's not right. You tax that person that owns the corporate jet. And for the most part, if they're legitimate people, for the most part, what's going to happen is they're not going to reinvest into the country. Then there won't be jobs. There won't be income coming in. And manufacturing and everything that we had and that we stood for with a free market society is going right down the tubes. And as a matter of fact, the Steve Jobs kind of guy. Yes, he makes the kind of money he makes, but you know what? Besides, he gives a lot to charity. But even if he didn't, it takes that kind of mentality to be able to produce the kind of a service or a product that's going to cause other people to go to work. And there's going to be products, and there's going to be the money circulating within the different cities, the different townships, the states. Because if I spend a dollar, that dollar is going to circle 6-7 times.
The game changer is Dresser After Dark, Michael Ray Dresser and his program, and all of the other Michael Ray Dressers and their programs on talk radio and the web and the blogs and everybody who gets information from different sources or provides information. It's you and me and our voices and what we talk about, and we help to get the word out there. Hopefully that it will make a difference, so that when the administration puts out the big lie, as the spokesman did this morning, that things are vastly improved economically in this country under this administration over where they were in the prior administration. Well, the test comes next year. We either buy that pablum or we buy the truth. The difference is, and this is the game changer, is that the truth is getting out, thanks to people like you and all of the other folks who are out there putting out the truth. The truth is out there. The question is, do enough of us have the character to go listen to the truth and then live out the truth? You said, don't judge them by their words, but by their conduct. And you weren't the first person to say that. And of course, that's what we should be doing. We should be judging everybody, Republicans, Democrats, the president, governmental folks, non-governmental folks, my clients, the people that I have to deal with on my clients' behalf, people in our families. We all have to judge them not just by what they say, but by their behavior. And based on their behavior, it's a very simple question to ask ourselves in November next year. Do these people deserve to be returned to office? And hopefully enough people will have gotten enough information from you and your cohorts, if you will, and have enough common sense left and enough belief in the promise of America that they will pull the lever the right way by adding all those influences together and reaching the right decision. We have to have faith and trust in the people, that the American people are going to take advantage of the opportunities that have been presented to them to know what's really going on and to understand what's really going on, in which they are hugely interested and are very actively engaged. It's going to make a difference. We've got to have that faith, because if we don't, Michael Ray, and we're right about not having that faith, we're all going over a cliff in 2013.
No, absolutely. There's no question about that. Michael, we're just running out of time. Website we can find you at?
We're busy working away at www.homeierlaw.com, spelled HOMEIERLAW.com.
Hey, Michael Homeier, we'll see you next week. Hey, thank you so much for being here.
Looking forward to it. A lot of news between now and then.
Oh, you bet. Okay, good night.
Good night.
There's so many exciting and wonderful places, mountains and jungles and desert oases, pleasant as home is, it isn't what Rome is, so why stay there, when there are so many fabulous faraway places to see? Why should Spain and Tahiti and Rio just be only names to you and me? I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Bill Crawford with us. He is the author of Life from the Top of the Mind. In addition to holding a doctorate in psychology from the University of Houston, he's a licensed psychologist, author of four books, organizational consultant, and he's a speaker. And over the last 26 years, he's created 3,300 presentations for such organizations as Sprint, Shell, the Texas Medical Center, PBS, and the list goes on. And let us say, Bill Crawford, I welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael Ray. Good to be with you.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. Let's talk about that S word that is just it is running rampant through this country today, basically the world. It's called stress. There are so many people, Bill, that are so stressed out, and it's coming from so many directions. Let's define what it is, and let's see if we can fix this thing.
You know, that's a great way to start, because I think so many people have been given some bad information about what stress really is. They think stress is something that someone or something does to them, like traffic stresses them out, work stresses them, politics stress them out. And the good news is that's not true, because if that were true, we would have to change all that before we could feel any differently or deal with it any more effectively. What stress really is actually just a chemical change in our body triggered by a very specific part of the brain. And this is the new information that I bring people in my books and my seminars that actually shows them how to change the chemical makeup of their body and engage a very specific part of the brain while avoiding the stressful part of the brain that allows them to bring this clarity, confidence, and creativity to life.
Okay, let's see if we can get an example of this. We're at a party, and you walk into the room, and I'm standing there, and I'm talking to people, and I look at you, and somehow there's something in you, I'm projecting now, there's something in you I don't like. There's something wrong there. Now I'm going to have a chemical reaction. I may get an adrenaline rush. Okay. Now, let's take the same situation. You walk into the room, I see you, there's something about you I like, and I get this dopamine rush, right? So, in essence, based on what we see, a chemical reaction is triggered, and that's usually based on an unconscious activation of a memory from somewhere in our past.
That's right. And here's the beauty of this. Once the new brain imagery has discovered that we've got basically three parts to the brain. The lower part of the brain that goes down the neck is called the brainstem. This is where our fight or flight responses are located. It's the part of the brain that regulates our muscle tension, blood pressure, heart rate, etc. The middle part of the brain, between the ears, right behind the eyes, is called the limbic system, but you can just call it the middle part. That is the part that reacts. That's the part that acts as a scanner and a router. It scans incoming information, whatever we see, whatever we hear, whatever we taste, whatever we feel, those five senses, and it routes it either down to the brainstem, that lower part, or up to what I call the top of the mind or the upper 80% of the brain called the neocortex. That's where we have access to the qualities and characteristics we need to succeed.
Now, the limbic system, that's the pleasure part of the brain, isn't it?
It's part of it, but it's also a part of the brain that is designed to keep us safe. For instance, millions of years ago, we're walking through the forest, we hear a saber-toothed tiger, and the saber-toothed tiger eats our friend, okay? So the limbic system goes, oh no, and it codes that the sound of a saber-toothed tiger, so that the next time we're walking through the jungle and hear a saber-toothed tiger, we react in a fight-or-flight way. That's a wonderful experience in a fight-or-flight situation, but hardly any of the situations we're dealing with today are truly fight-or-flight in nature. But the problem is we're engaging this fight-or-flight part of the brain, and people don't know what's going on, and they certainly don't know what to do about it.
Okay, let's see if we can say that a little bit of a different way. You've got this central nervous system, and that central nervous system is basically conscious activity. Then you've got the autonomic nervous system, which is unconscious activity. Two parts of that is the sympathetic, the parasympathetic nervous system. That's where the fight or flight takes place. All of it's triggered, but let's go back to this unconscious system for a moment. It controls your heart, your liver, your digestive system. You know, you're not thinking about doing all of these things. And I think the big problem, Bill, is exactly what you're talking about. When somebody triggers something, it goes to this autonomic nervous system, and it's unconscious, and you're not even aware of it. And from what I'm hearing you say, and stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician, what I'm hearing you say, if you are aware of it, then you can bring it to consciousness, and if you can bring it to consciousness, you can control it.
Yes, and that's exactly right, and even more so. Rather than thinking that traffic stresses me out, or this particular guy stresses me out, or whatever, rather than looking externally for our stressors or our triggers, what we want to understand is, okay, data is being sent to the wrong part of the brain. That's just good information. And then here's the key. We've got to know that, and then we've got to know what to do. We've got to know how to shift from that lower 20% to the upper 80%. And that's what I teach. I've created a three-part system that is designed, the first part is designed to help you understand when you're in that lower 20%, know exactly what to do in terms of shifting to the upper 80%. You change the chemical makeup of your body from adrenaline, noradrenaline, and cortisol to serotonin and endorphins. And that's a beautiful experience. Now, that's great, but you don't want to stop there, because then if you went back into another situation, you'd fall back into that lower 20%. So the second part of my system is, okay, once you've shifted to what I call the top of the mind, or this upper 80%, and access that clarity, confidence, creativity, compassion, it's not just an intellectual system, it's about compassion as well. Once you've accessed that, how do you stay there? And how do you bring those qualities to all aspects of life? And then part three is what I call graduate school, because that's the tough part. This is dealing with other people. You know, it's one thing to deal with a printer or a traffic or a deadline, but when somebody is in your face, that's the tough part to deal with. So part three teaches people how to engage others who might be resistant to them or upset with them in such a way so that those other people shift from their brainstem to their neocortex, so you can now have a solution-focused conversation versus a who's-to-blame debate.
Okay, let's I can't remember the exact names we called each other, but my sister and I got into an argument.
Uh-huh.
Rarely it happens, but it happens, all right? So I'm standing there.
Sure.
She's mad at me, and I'm mad at her. And I said to her, I said, you loser. And she said, oh, you're just a dependent on everybody. And I stormed out of the room. And then I stopped for a second, and I smiled. It took me about, probably 20, 30 seconds. And when I smiled, I changed the chemistry. And then when I realized what happened, I walked back into the room, stuck my tongue out at her, and she smiled at me. And what I realized was what I called her was what I thought I was. And what she called me is what she thought she was. And it was a very interesting thing. We both laughed about it, and it was over. The entire thing was over in a matter of maybe 7 or 8 minutes from the beginning. And I think that in and of itself is, that's why I think what you're doing is brilliant, because if you can get somebody to recognize it, you can be in control of it instead of it being in control of you.
That's a beautiful way to describe it, because the experience you just described, you had this negative experience. You felt angry. You felt hurt. You felt attacked. You said something. You left the room. But then you had an awareness. There's this quote from Albert Einstein that I love that says, problems cannot be solved at the same level of awareness that created them. And I use that in my book and my seminars, because this is all about understanding where this emotion comes from. Rather than my sister made me mad, you recognized you were responding to something kind of within you. Now, you don't have to blame yourself, but you stop blaming your sister and you smiled. That's the beautiful part of that, because, see, smiling, you can only smile from the top of the mind. The brain stem, this fight-or-flight part of the brain, does not want to smile. It does not want to calm down. It does not want to take a deep breath. It wants to be right, and it wants to either fight or run away. And so once you've discovered that you were in that part of the brain and you smiled, that engaged the neocortex. And you were able to, thank goodness that you have the kind of family where you can go back in and laugh about that. Unfortunately, so many people have such toxic kind of family relations that, boy, that kind of fight would have lasted, another 2 months.
Oh, sure. And one of the reasons for that, and I think it's extremely important, we're driven by things that we don't recognize at the time. We recognize an experience that we're sitting in front of today, the emotion ties to it that we, from an experience we had years and years ago. And we don't put the two together. And whatever's going on, that person that we are quote unquote yelling at, they've got nothing to do with it for the most part, and vice versa. And I think that's critical. If we begin to realize that, then all of a sudden I'm responsible for my emotions, and it's nothing to do with her. It's all about me and what I recognize that triggered something in me from who knows how many years ago.
Yeah. And, again, what we want to do often when we're in one of those interactions is we want that person to change. But when we go and address them from our brainstem, from our anger, from our frustration, from our stress, what will almost always happen is they will start defending the very behavior we want them to change. That's why this is so critical that people begin to understand what is truly going on, because we need to really know that everything we do and everything we say and everything we feel is controlled by how our brain processes information. And therefore, if we want to be influential in our lives, how we do our jobs, how we communicate with our colleagues, our kids, how we feel, how we act, we've got to be able to influence that process. And I've been working with people for over the last 25, 26 years teaching this system, and they say, finally, not just soft skills, but hard science. You've given me a way of understanding my emotions and the emotions of others, my reactions and the reactions of others, that takes me out of this loop, this cycle, and allows me to be more influential in my own mind, in my own perspective, and then, here's the magical part, is become more influential with others.
Sure, no question about it. And I think the biggest thing that happens, the biggest problem that occurs, and you were talking about processing a moment ago, it's when you can't process, when it comes in at you so fast that you don't have the ability to deal with what's going on, that's when it hits. There's that analytical sense of evaluation. There's an inhibitory process. It's like a filtering system between that conscious and that unconscious mind. As long as that's there, we're good. But if we get overloaded, this breaks down. Bill, when this breaks down, things pour into that unconscious mind, which doesn't know the difference between right or wrong, takes it on as a goal to achieve once it gets there. That's where the fight or flight happens, and that's where the arguments and the battling and everything else go on that don't really have to.
Yeah, and I've got a great question for people, because people say, Bill, I love this material, but, you know, what am I supposed to do? Say, excuse me, I need to shift to another part of the brain. You know, they have this concern that they're going to be in the middle of a situation, and they won't know what to do. So I ask them this one simple question. What would you do if you had diarrhea? And they go, what? And I said, yeah, what would you do? Well, I'd leave the room and I'd take care of it. I say, okay, you want to make your peace of mind, your serenity, your ability to come from the most intelligent, capable, purposeful, compassionate part of your brain at least as important as diarrhea. Which means if you would stop this argument for diarrhea, if you would leave the room for diarrhea, then you leave for this signal. One of the things I say in my book is stress is a signal something needs to change. Suffering
sure.
is when we don't make the change. So when we can start seeing that signal and say, excuse me, I've got to go to the bathroom. The couples that I work with, this is now a code between them. Whenever they're about to say something that they know they're going to regret, but they almost can't stop themselves, they say, I got to go to the bathroom. And everybody kind of knows what that's all about. It's a way of leaving the situation, composing yourself, shifting from that lower brain to the upper brain, coming back, and being more purposeful.
Now, by the way, there's one easy way to do it, and it was mentioned early on, a simple smile. Because the moment you smile, that old adage that laughter is the best medicine, what actually happens when you laugh, your brain releases endorphins, in turn, calms you down, makes you feel good. So a simple smile, thinking about a puppy, thinking about a something, it's that shift in consciousness which will shift the emotion, which will change everything that's going on at that moment between the two of you.
I agree. And there's also a magic question. There are actually four questions that I give people to help them shift. But there's one I think that's one of the most powerful. It says, would I teach whatever I'm feeling, whatever I'm thinking, this thought, emotion, or action, would I teach this to a child or someone I loved? And when people hear that in my sessions and in my seminars, they go, wow, because, you know, we would never teach someone we love to be stressed and frustrated and angry and defensive and resentful and all the things we sometimes find ourselves feeling. Matter of fact,
let me hold you up, because I think right there, at that moment, there's a very important message here. You said, would we teach them? Bill, I think the problem is we do teach them. You hear it?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, we do. They model. So, yes,
I
guess it's the difference between an intentional teach or an accidental teach.
Exactly. We are always teaching, and that's kind of the good news and the bad news. But what would we do it on purpose? Would we do it deliberately? And that's where it accesses that wise, loving, nurturing part that all of us have. And that's where people can begin to say, okay, if my child were sitting right there, or my niece, or my nephew, or my younger brother, any younger person, and they were saying, okay, Dad, show me how to do this. Teach me something. We would become very purposeful, and we would be coming from that upper 80% of the brain.
Yeah. I mean, by the way, there is no question about it. We are starting to run out of time. Bill Crawford, is there a website we can find you at?
There is, and there's a couple of ways, several ways people can learn this. They can go to my website, which is BillCPhD.com, BillCPhD.com, or they can just Google Bill Crawford PhD, and I'll pop up on the first page. They can buy my book, Life from the Top of the Mind. It's got the system kind of mapped out in there, And most recently, I've just created a 10-disc audio system that they can buy, that I walk them through this system. And this particular 10-disc audio system comes with 4 free sessions with me. So we do it over the phone, or they come to Houston, or I come to wherever they are, however they want to do it, and I help them learn this new way of being.
By the way, I think it's absolutely great. Okay, now, by the way, I've appreciated your time with us. I'm sorry we're running out of time so fast. And I've been around this long enough where I really like what you have to say.
Oh, thanks.
Okay, we're just about out of time.
It was great when I kind of was invited to your program. I kind of listened to some of your stuff, and I love the passion you bring to your subjects, and I can understand why you have tons of listeners, and I love the tagline, kind of where authors and experts come to share and spread the word. You know, that's a beautiful thing.
And it is. Hey, Bill Crawford, thank you so much, and thank you for being here.
My pleasure, Michael Ray. Hope we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. Good night.
Good night.
I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be. Like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Elaine Grohman with us. She is the author of The Angels in Me, Experiences of Receiving and Sharing Divine Communications. She's an associate polarity practitioner, a certified healing touch practitioner, an angel therapy practitioner, and the developer and teacher of a new energetic modality called Healing from the Fourth Dimension, Sacred Geometry and Energy Medicine, Levels 1 and 2, which she's been teaching since 2002. Elaine, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be on your show.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, there came a time when people were just tied to allopathic medicine. The doctor said this is what it is, and you take that medicine, and people were frightened of it. Then too many people realized that a lot of it wasn't working. And by the way, allopathic medicine absolutely has its place. But then they started to look for alternatives. And I think what we've really gone back to, and I say we, most people, are what healed us in the first place, the things before the chemicals.
That's right. You know, I think that's so important for people to really begin to understand, especially people in medicine, Michael. And I think that I really am very grateful because I have the opportunity to work with two medical schools in Michigan, which is where I'm from, for the past 10 years to help medical students understand perhaps what their patients might be seeking in addition to or a complement with whatever traditional allopathic model of care that they're getting. And that's a unique perspective, I think, that they're doing, is rather than trying to teach an old dog new tricks, they're teaching the young students how to look at, maybe not necessarily that they're going to use it themselves, but to know that their patients are seeking it. So I think that that's an important thing.
Sure. Now, by the way, when we talk about divine communications, define that. What are we dealing with? And we'll lay a base, and then we'll move from there.
Okay. Well, what I refer to as divine communication is there's spirit around us all the time. If we look back in traditional Native American culture, for instance, you know, there's always what would be called the Great Spirit. And then as religion came along, we kind of defined them in terms that were familiar for us, whether that would be angels or beings of light or whatever you wanted to call them. But to me, really, they're the same thing. There is this divine creation that is around us that supports us. And if we're wise, we listen to that still soft voice within us to have some direction of what is a good way to go to bring better things into our lives.
Now, by the way, when we talk communication, and then most people think the word communication means you're talking to someone. And communication in and of itself is conversing with someone, but it doesn't have to be through a spoken language. It can be through energy. It can be through so many different things, pictures, symbols, etc. And when you deal with divine communications, it doesn't necessarily mean you have to talk to spirits, does it?
No, it doesn't. You know, I think I'm glad that you brought that up, because one of the things that I teach people is to really learn to pay attention to the gifts that are innately human, all of our senses. So communication is multisensory in that it's what we hear, what we see, what we think, what we feel, what we intuit. And all of those are equally as important for us to pay attention to. Although some people may have an aptitude for hearing things or seeing things, that doesn't make that better or worse than the other person's gift. But I think that what we have unfortunately kind of gone away from is really paying attention to our feelings, and in our Western world, we're more paying attention to our thinking, which may not be as clear as our feelings.
Now, by the way, there is a reversible cause and effect with thinking and feeling, but one thing I think is very important, and I guess a prime example of this would be when you talk about energetic modality, energy, and I guess mm-hmm. a great example of energy would be this, that I see you across the room and I walk over and I say, would you like to dance? There's a certain energy that's going on between the two of us at the moment. Connection, non-connection, it doesn't really matter. But the minute we get on the dance floor, the music starts to play. And the vibration of the music in and of itself is an energy, and it changes the vibration in your body, and it also changes your emotions. And for that 3 or 4 minutes that we're dancing, the music is guiding the emotion and your physiology.
Well, I'd say that absolutely that's true. And I think that what you said as you approach someone across a room, we're initially being connected with each other by our emotions and that vibration of that emotion. And I think that what we're being shown in science and so many different things is everything is a frequency. Everything is a frequency. So we are, by nature, energetic beings that respond to different frequencies, good frequencies that obviously make us feel good, healthy, etc., and feelings that are maybe a little bit negative, which I really don't like to use the term negative, but rather more a lower frequency, which we often interpret as a negative thing because it doesn't feel good. It doesn't feel inviting. It doesn't feel nurturing, that kind of thing. So you're right in that everything is vibration.
Sure,
physics is proving that.
Yeah, and our brain is it's an electrochemical factory. And what it does, it moves energy through neurons and et cetera. We don't have to get into that, but it moves energy through the body. And it sends out signals to certain parts of the body. And every once in a while, there's a disconnect. And it's where the disconnect is where the problem is. And I would imagine, and please stop me if I'm wrong, I'm not a clinician here, but I imagine that what you do is reconnect, because that disconnect is what causes all of the problems that we have, whether it be physical, emotional, even intellectual. It's when everything is not flowing and there's not homeostasis, when there's not balance.
That's correct. And, you know, when I'm trying to help someone understand something that is really not very tangible to them, is I try to make analogies by way of examples of things that are common occurrences. So if I'm explaining this to someone, I might say, imagine that, Michael, you're someone who is not feeling well. And you then might be analogous to a car with a dead battery. Okay? The car has everything it needs. It has all the components it needs. It just doesn't have enough oomph. It doesn't have enough energy. So a brand new car can come and sit right next to it, but that really doesn't do anything either. What you need is a mechanism of movement, which is then that jumper cable. So my role as an energy healer is to help to allow the movement of energy from one area to another to help to, for lack of a better way to say it, charge a battery that's too low. So I work with a lot of people. Initially, how I got into this actually was in a hospice situation. So as you might expect, I was in the worst-case scenarios day after day after day. And so that it was very palpable to feel all the disease processes that were happening in the body. Now, what's important, I think, Michael, for people to understand is that healing does not necessarily mean cure. Healing means relief. Relief of anxiety, relief of the stress, relief of the anger, an emotion that has not served us well. And even in a hospice situation, in a dying situation, I have been at deaths where actually a healing occurred, meaning someone was able to release an anger or to forgive something. There's so many beautiful myriad ways that healing actually occurs.
Okay, but let's take that a step farther in the healing process. The cure in and of itself comes from your immune system. Any way you look at it, it's the immune system that's going to make or break you one way or the other. And right, when you can release the emotion, the tension, then it allows the immune system to work. And there's going to be the cure, there's going to be the physical healing or not. It can come at a point where if you choose to die, you're going to die. And I really believe in my heart of hearts that if you can let things go beforehand, then, you know, you move out on an even keel. But most people don't want to do that. They won't let go. And they won't let go for one reason and one reason only. It's given them identity. As long as I've got that hate inside of me, as long as I've got that anger inside of me, it allows me to identify myself. It's my purpose for living. And I think the biggest thing that happens, Elaine, is people don't have purpose in their life. And if you don't have purpose and if you're not accepted and you're not recognized, then you're an outsider. And then all of those things happen to you. If it's a kid, you can join a gang. Or if you're not a kid and you need to be recognized, you might be angry and depressed all the time, and that's how you get your attention. And I really think if you could find purpose, if you could find yourself within your life, a lot of this stuff wouldn't have to happen. Didn't say it would happen or wouldn't happen, but it doesn't have to happen.
You know, I would like to take that a little step further, if I may. I think that also what we recognize when people have a lot of anger, et cetera, in themselves, what we're really recognizing is people that don't understand love, because love is the highest vibration there is. And when you look at someone who is angry, it's so easy to make a judgment about their behavior, about what they do, and then that causes further separation. But really what we're identifying and looking at when we see someone who's so angry is someone who does not love themselves. And when we really have to really think very differently about how we treat one another and how we really begin to be self-nurturing so that there is a much more amenable way of dealing with situations rather than just reacting to situations. And I think that we have a tendency to react in many ways that are not healthy, which cause stress. And as we know, stress is a precursor to so many illnesses. So I think we have to rethink how, especially in the patriarchal way that we have been governed in so many ways, from political realms to the community to religion, you know, a very patriarchal way has not always brought nurturance. In fact, it rarely has. So I think that we have to. Pardon me.
Go ahead. I thought you were done. Go ahead.
I think that we have to then look at how do we abate the anger? How do we stop the anger and have an open dialogue so that it's not always a battleground?
One of the things that I found over the years if we could define something that you can work with it. Most people, Elaine, have a problem. They work on a problem they don't have instead of the one that they do have, and they're always into that whatever that turmoil it is that they're into. I think a great definition of anger, it's blocked expression. And if you can't express, if you can't externalize it, it's going to go internally. And because I can't think of anybody got mad at anybody who had anger for somebody that they could talk to or agreed with them. So a lot of that truly is, it's blocked expression. And if you could sit down and just the what to think about is, what is it that they're not hearing? You know, and then if you can catch that, that's got to be one of the first steps.
That's right. You know, and I just had this conversation a little bit earlier today with someone. You know, so many people have a reaction to something. And then we might find ourselves in a defensive mode. But if we were to just stop for a moment and ask that person who is being a little bit abrasive, you know, what is it, how does it help you to have this belief? Or how does it help you to have this feeling? If you can somehow, in a non-confrontational way, help someone to begin to be more self-reflective and understand why on earth do I have this feeling? And often it's a habitual response rather than an actually thought-out response. And I think that's part of the problem, is people simply react to things rather than necessarily acting in an appropriate fashion for what's happening.
You know, it took me probably 150 years, but in today's world, before I really respond to anything, I'll usually take a breath. And that moment of breath makes all the difference in the world. Now, you couldn't say that to Radio Susie, because she's constantly throwing computers at me while I'm on the air when I'm not doing something I'm supposed to do. But for the most part, it's just called take a breath. And yeah. And there's such a difference in the outcome.
That's right. That's right. And that's what's so extraordinary about the work that I get to do, really, is I feel very privileged in being able to step into people's lives and really recognize that that's a holy place where I am, where I step into someone's life and I can see what they maybe can't see about themselves because they're so enmeshed in it.
No, absolutely.
Pardon me?
Oh, I said no question about it.
Yeah, and if I can give them a different perspective and give them a slightly different view of how they might look at it, sometimes then people are willing and able to set down their armaments. You know,
no question.
We're so used to going to battle.
Oh, sure. No, there's no question about that. Now, we're starting to run out of time. Let me ask you a quick question. Angel therapy, what's that?
Angel therapy is actually, I had the great pleasure of studying with Doreen Virtue, and many people know who she, you know, if you go to the metaphysical part of a bookstore, 90% of the books are by her. But I was having experiences when I started to do energy work. I started to hear things about people, what was happening, what was happening in their lives, things that had physiologically happened, etc. And I wanted to understand what that was, who that was, so that I could give that information clearly. So when I do an angel reading with someone, I'm literally just sitting down and trying to be a clear vessel to give them guidance, to have their life open more fully with love. I am not dramatic and tell them all kinds of crazy things. I tell them, how do you love your life better? How do you act as a human in this life better? And so it really is a part of the healing process. For me.
And I hear it loud and clear. Okay, we're out of time. Let me ask you this. Elaine, website we can find you at, find your work, buy the books. Where can we find you?
Thank you. I do have a website. It's www.elaine.groman.com. On that, it has a list of events, workshops that I teach. You could buy my book, etc. And if someone's interested in signing on to that, I'd be happy to send them my newsletter and let them know what I'm doing.
Wonderful. Elaine Groman, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you so much for the opportunity, and bless you for what you do.
Oh, thank you. Good night.
Good night.
You miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm gone away. gonna feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, honey, you always got your way. Say, baby, if you really want me in Rome, yeah, you know it's gonna grieve me. You're gonna miss your bony little daddy. Comes a one of these, yeah. Said some of these days I do it so good, you're gonna miss me, honey. And I'm talking about days when you feel all blue. You're gonna miss my hugging, you're gonna miss my kissing. You may even miss me, baby, when I'm long gone away. I hope you feel lonely and want me only, 'cause you know, lover, you always had your way. And if you
welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to thought-provoking talk on Dresser After Dark. Laura Laguerre is with us, and she's the author of It's Not Weird Anymore, An Extraordinary True Tale. Our specialty as a massage therapist is the art of science of using and applying therapeutic-grade, and listen to the words, essential oils for emotional release, for healing, for toxic and nutrition. And since 1996, she's continuously studied aromatherapy with Dr. Gary Young, ND. She teaches the practical use of essential oils for your everyday life and business in her aromatherapy seminar, and is level 1 and 2. That's aromatherapy versus the poison personal care products in industry, fast junk food, and pharmaceutical drugs. And let us say, hi, Laura, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael, and thank you for having me on.
Oh, did I pronounce your last name right? I just took a shot at it.
I think so. You said Laguerre?
I was close, though. How do you pronounce your last name?
Laguerre.
Laguerre. Okay, I did a G instead of a Z. I got it now.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's okay. That's what everybody, a lot of people get that.
Okay, it's Laguerre.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me on.
Oh, my pleasure. You know, aromatherapy, I think it's great. When I go to sleep at night and I have a little trouble breathing, what is it that I've got? I've got something up there. It's aromatherapy. It's an essential oil. What is it that helps you breathe?
Oh, you mean your olfactory system? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, or just breathing. What is it that helps you breathe? Which one of the essential oils?
Oh, which one of the oils?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you were talking about the brain. Okay. Yeah, any of them help you breathe because they're like a little bottle of oxygen.
Yeah.
They're the most concentrated, huh?
Yeah, I was going to say, one especially I've got up in the bedroom and it's sitting on the nightstand, and if I ever have problems, I use that, and this stuff is so good.
Which one is it?
I'm trying to think of it. You know, if I remember at 3 o'clock in the morning, I'll call you. it'll come. I'll think of it during the show. It'll hit me.
Okay, well, essential oils are the blood of the plant. They're the most concentrated part of the plant that you can possibly get, and it takes up to an entire plant or more to get actually one drop out. And so one drop of Young Living peppermint oil is equivalent to 28 cups of peppermint tea.
Wow.
So that's why they're so powerful. But there also is... There's a lot of essential oils out there, and really 77% of them out there are actually synthetic and toxic. there isn't any oil in them at all. There's companies that basically make synthetic, what they call essential oils, but it's really just a smell. They know how to mimic all kinds of smells, hamburgers, whatever. And then 22% of the oils out there are actually stretched. So they have a lot of extra whatever in there, like oil, extra like maybe olive oil or something in there.
Yeah.
And then 1% actually have the real thing. And so it's really an art to do that. And so I've had the privilege to study with Gary Young since 96, and he totally and utterly prepared me for my accident I had.
Mm. By the way, let me hold you up just for a second.
Yeah.
Actually, it's going to be the same question. You're going to lead into it. I was going to say, what was your exposure to essential oils that really triggered you to realize that there was something here?
Oh, well, that happened early on in my massage practice. I had tried to get into essential oils before I got turned on to Young Living oils, and I was really disappointed. I didn't really know what they were supposed to do because I hadn't really experienced the real thing. But I just was experimenting with different things, and it just seemed like it wasn't doing anything except maybe it smelled, but they weren't doing anything. And my last straw was buying... I went to an initiation for all these ministers, and this woman had come back from China, and she had this frankincense that was amazing. Everything just felt euphoric in the whole room, and I hadn't, you know, I hadn't ever had that experience before. And I asked her, "Where can I get this?" And she said, "Well, I got it in China." And then she shrugged her shoulders. She didn't know where I could get it. So I went, frankincense, I got to get frankincense. So I went to just a store and got some frankincense, got home and smelled it, and it was terrible. It stunk horrible. And I just thought, I don't know what I'm doing, but it's not right. So I poured all my oils out, and about 2 or 3 months later, a friend of mine who's influenced a lot of my work came to visit me, and she goes, I want you to try these oils out. And I was like, well, all right, I'll try them. So she got me down on the floor and gave me this essential oil treatment, and I had that euphoria again. Because they raise your vibration. And so I was like, this is what they're supposed to do. I get it. And then from there, I started using them on my clients, and my most severe client had MS, and she had it diagnosed on the brain. She couldn't remember what she was doing from 1 minute to the next, and her digestion was mixed up. She would have hot, like I would watch her body heat up in front of me. She would just turn red, and then she would have muscle spasms and pain. And we started doing raindrop therapy on her. We did it once a week for 2.5 years, and I watched all her symptoms go away.
Now, what's raindrop therapy?
Raindrop therapy is using particular oils in a specific order along the spine. You use first Valor, which is a blend that Young Living makes, and they nicknamed it Chiropractor in a Bottle. It actually will energetically align you, and people have felt it straighten their spine even just by dropping it on. And then I use oregano and thyme that pulls out viruses that hide along the spine. And then I use basil that helps with muscle spasms, and cypress helps with blood circulation. Wintergreen will help repair bone. Marjoram helps repair nerves and muscle. And then peppermint's good for any kind of pain whatsoever and digestion. And so you line all those up on the spine. You actually start out with doing the spine points on the feet first. Then you weave them in the spine, and they clean off receptor sites, which are at your nerve endings. Your receptor sites end up with all the toxins we're exposed to, and a lot with personal care products too, but we can eat a lot of foods that have chemicals in them. And your receptor sites will get covered up with these gunky toxins. And that's where your hormones and your proper cell function happen. And if they're gunked over, your systems aren't working right. And the oils actually can go in like little Pac-Man and clean off your receptor sites.
Aren't the oils, didn't they come from ancient medicine? The oils have been around forever, haven't they?
They have been around for a long, long time, yes. In Egypt, the royalty were the ones that were allowed to have the oils, but the peasants were only allowed to have the herbs.
By the way, I remember the oil now. Eucalyptus.
Okay, great. That's great for cleaning up your sinuses and helping you breathe more.
Yeah, breathing. Yeah, every once in a while, if you, you know, little allergies and whatever comes up, I got the eucalyptus. I put a little bit on on my nose, and it actually opens everything up and go right to sleep.
It does. Yeah,
no, it's good stuff. I know. But by the way, I'm a total believer in everything that you have to say, because there are alternative ways to get very healthy, and I don't know how many times that I think everybody should repeat the same thing, that allopathic medicine, chemical medicine is wonderful. There's a place for it. There's no question. But there's also the alternative, and the alternative was here long before the chemicals. So
that's true. It's always been there. And the chemical medicine is started out from a natural medicine.
Sure. Plants.
Right. So anyway, do you want me to tell you about how I healed myself from the accident in Mexico? Or
I'm sitting here. I'm waiting to hear. Yes, I'd love to hear.
Okay. So about 4.5 years ago, I was on a cruise with a friend, and we got off on the island of Cozumel, rented scooters, and it was the last day of the cruise. We were going back into town, and she was ahead of me, and I went off the road, went over the handlebars at 25 miles an hour. At least I had a helmet on, but no face shield. They don't have them there. And I plowed my face into a coral rock, and I broke my whole face. I broke my cheekbones, my upper palate in half. My nose was half off. I broke my orbital bone. I filled huge beach towels full of blood. And I didn't. This is an example. I mean, I can give you an example from the last guest you had, Elaine. I chose to chant internally, and so did my friend, silently, to calm everything down. While I was in, the only person that showed up right away was an American doctor and the ambulance. And we were in the middle of nowhere on an island. That was who came right away. So that once my friend and I got into the ambulance, we just started internally doing these Tibetan chants to just keep the energy clear. Because I have always felt that how you think about your situation or your choices make it better or worse. And I kept my mind clear the whole time. I just did this internal chant just to keep the energy from being this big drama. And then my friend was able to put the oils on me. Between the two of us, we had a lot of them. And she kept pouring the oils on my face, and it shrunk the swelling by 80% in 2 days.
Wow.
And they put 7 steel plates and 34 screws in my face. And I never had a headache. I have never had any pain whatsoever.
You still got the screws and the plates in your face?
Yeah. 2 years ago, they took out 9 screws and 2 plates around my right eye. But the rest of them just stay in there forever. I can't feel them. I could feel the ones around my right eye. If you've ever watched Star Trek The Next Generation, I felt like the Borg.
Oh, I got you. Loud and clear.
But now I don't.
Just don't get near a magnet. You'll be fine.
Well, it's funny. I don't trip off anything in the airport.
Yeah. That's interesting. You know, actually, it's in your face, so you're really safe. But you should trip something off, shouldn't you, if there's metal?
Well, not really. It's that when the surgeon showed us the plates, there are these titanium plates, and they you can wave them around, and they wave around like, you know, paper towels. They're very thin and flexible.
You know, one of the things that, you know, as you're speaking, one of the things that I'm really thinking about, Laura, is that thank goodness that happened to you. And the reason that I say that is There are so many times we get these challenges, these pains, something that happens in our life, and then if we, because you took it, and you appropriately dealt with it with the chanting in the very beginning, you controlled it from the get-go. And because of it, it allowed you to see a dimension of what you dealt with even stronger and deeper than you probably would have ever seen it, because it happened to you, and it happened to you in a way that it wasn't just a minor accident. And that in and of itself, when people ask you, how do you know? How do you really know it works? You've been there, you've done that, you walk the walk.
Right. That was interesting because I've done a lot of work on myself, and so it was like, okay, put it to the test then and see what happens. And it was really neat. I really feel like I've been in this cosmic flow of allowing things to show up that are helpful to you if you stay out of your way, if your mind doesn't go off and make up all this crap. Sorry, excuse me. Make up all this stuff.
We'll live through it. It's okay.
Huh?
I said, we'll live through it. It's okay.
If we, our mind will take it and start just making it crazy. And I saw this, really neat YouTube clip explaining how powerful our thoughts are. And this one doctor, Dr. Alberto Villotto, he's a PhD, and he says the brain does not distinguish between the past and the present. So if something happened to you in the past and you keep living that thing in your mind, it's like driving it into your body as if it's still the same story, that just it's as if it just happened.
Yeah, the brain doesn't distinguish between fact or fantasy. Once something gets in there, in the unconscious mind especially, that it takes it on as a goal to achieve, and it doesn't speak a language like we do. It speaks a language of pictures and symbols, and it doesn't think, it doesn't reason. If it's in there, then it's reality, and you just said it. You're going to respond to it, whether even if it's 20 years later, you're going to respond to the emotion, and you're going to have the reaction from it. Sure.
So that's what I feel like this is the subject. I mean, this is a bigger subject now. I mean, that seems to be, everybody seems to be talking about it now, which is good, because it's important for us as a collective to start really getting rid of our old stories and creating something that really works for us.
No question. Laura, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Yes. It'snotweirdanymore.com. Or lauralegere.com, either one of those. And if they want to buy my book, they can send me an email, a copy of the receipt, and I'll send them a free PDF file of 110 uses for 9 essential oils. It's a first aid kit.
Wonderful. Hey, Laura Legere, I want to thank you so much for joining us tonight.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
All right. Bye.
To you and me, I feel certain there's people we'd be glad to know there. So tell me, why don't we get up and just go there? Go to those fabulous places where we long to be, like Bangkok, Hong Kong, Paris and Venice, Tokyo and Cairo and Lisbon and London. Wonderful, fabulous places we're longing to see. There are so many simply incredible places to see. When I think of the warm Caribbean, I see a new world for you and me. I'd give anything just to have one single day there. And once we get there, I know that we'll stay there. Stay in those fabulous places where we long to be.
like Bangkok, Hong Kong, and Paris, and Venice, Tokyo, and Cairo, and Lisbon, and London, Siam, Siena, Vienna, Verona, Java, Jamaica, Bombay, Barcelona. Show me those fabulous places we're longing to see.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought-Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. David Dodd with us. He is the co-author of Economic Development in the New Millennium. It was published by the American Economic Development Council. He's an economic development expert, and he's led the Gulf Coast Reinvestment Forum after Hurricanes Katrina and Hurricanes Rita. Recently toured the Japan disaster region, and he says the entire cities were wiped away, and although disasters occurred over 5 months ago, some of the areas are still cleaning debris and counting the deceased. And let us say hi, welcome to the show, David.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
Oh, I am good, and thank you so much for being here. You know, we hear so much information about, you know, economic disaster. We heard about Katrina. We heard about Rita. But they're just a piece of it, because once you get into it, there are horrendous things that happen. There's destruction, but there's also something called economic recovery. And Japan, as bad as that is, or God, there still is that little bit of light, that little bit of something that says they can recover, even though it looks almost impossible.
Yeah, you know, I was involved in the recovery effort after Katrina and Rita, as you mentioned, and I saw tremendous resilience in the people along the Gulf Coast. But the resilience and the attitude of the Japanese in the wake of this horrendous disaster, we're talking about an area that was 310 miles long and 124 miles wide of total destruction. 25,000 people confirmed dead or missing. Economic damage estimated at $300 to $350 billion. Compare that to Katrina and Rita, which one life lost is too many, Michael, but 1,700 lives there, damage at $150 to $200 billion. You can see the enormity of this disaster. And the Japanese people are absolutely determined to rebuild better and stronger.
Now, David, you're president of Dadco Consulting, and that's in Louisiana. How close were you to that disaster? How did it affect your life?
I'm actually on the other end of the state. Shreveport is 3 hours due east of Dallas. So our culture is actually closer, and our economic picture is actually closer to Dallas than New Orleans, which is 300 miles away. However, we're all Louisianians, and we received about 20,000 evacuees after Katrina and Rita. I actually put up an evacuee who was a friend of mine in my home for about 3 weeks. So I saw that firsthand and was down there shortly after. And make no mistake, it was a horrendous event. But again, when you look at that compared to what happened off the coast of Japan, plus the nuclear disaster, you know, added to that, and the power shortages that Japan continues to experience. I mentioned to you in my briefing paper that I was warm the entire time, and hey, I'm from the South, but every air conditioning unit in every public space was cut off because about 30% of their electric power has been crippled, and that's going to take a while for them to recover from that. But you know, their attitude is we'll get through it. We'll make it work. The Prime Minister, I mean, if you've ever been to Japan or dealt with Japanese in businesses, especially, they're very formally dressed. Normally, coat and tie is absolutely required. Even the Prime Minister was sporting an open collared shirt because you know, trying to make a statement of solidarity in these power cutbacks.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with, and I have to say we, because globally we're affected, but when we're dealing with something like Japan, we take a look at it, the one thing that I noticed was the bonding of the people, the camaraderie, the reaching out to one another. I thought they handled it with what they had to put up with and what they went through. They handled it beautifully.
Yeah, and I sent you a series of photos, and hopefully we can get those up. I have them up on my website, and hopefully we can get those up on yours. There's one photo of a line about 300 yards long of, now remember, this is 3 months after the disaster, of refugees who are living in tents. They're waiting for their daily supply of food and nourishment and supplies. Not one person is out of line. Not one person is complaining. And we saw that continuously throughout. The attitude of the Japanese people is just incredible. And everywhere that we went, there were children playing in one of the UN relief centers we went to, and they were smiling. And the people were telling us, yes, this has been a tragedy. Some had lost relatives, but they all say the same thing. We know that this happened. We know that we can't be in despair. We have to go on.
Now, by the way, David, looking at this and the way that they handled it, economic recovery, the difference between what happened in Louisiana and what happened in Japan, the way they dealt with it in Louisiana and the way they dealt with it in Japan, would there be a difference in the way that we would get economic recovery? And I mean, is there, Japan seems like it was all moving in the same direction. Louisiana looked like it was moving seven different directions and hard to get together and move down one road for focus.
Yeah, and let me distinguish between disaster relief and disaster recovery. Relief is immediate. That is dealing with people that are being displaced, looking for those that have been lost, doing the types of things that you have to do in an emergency situation. Recovery is different, and that's where I specialize. That's after the disaster is over, and you're looking at how do you rebuild? What do you need to do to engage companies, the private sector, to invest? What do you need to do to rebuild the community, build the infrastructure, make it so that it still retains the character of the community, yet it's more resistant to this type of disaster happening again? And, of course, in the relief effort along the Gulf Coast, we all know we've seen the photos of people in the Superdome, and that was a tremendously hard situation. In Japan, they certainly had their share of difficulties. The government, by some, was criticized for not responding quickly enough. However, there was, a unity of purpose of the people that were affected in getting through that process as fast as possible and starting the rebuilding. And, Michael, they're still cleaning up. Some of the photos I sent to you, and that will be up on my website, show debris piles 200 feet tall. I mean, there were cities that were completely wiped away. We visited two cities, one of which had a handful of buildings left, one of which was a city of about 20,000 people, only had five or six buildings left. Everything else was completely washed away. So when you're looking at that and saying, okay, how do we develop a strategy for recovery? Well, the first thing you look at when you're dealing with trying to reengage the private sector is risk. What can you do to mitigate the risk so that they feel comfortable in investing or reinvesting in the area? And that can be done through a variety of means, economic incentives, infrastructure investments by the public sector, co-investing with the private sector in various ways, as we did after Katrina and Rita along the Gulf Coast.
One of the biggest problems I would imagine that Japan would have had, because it was so devastating and it was such a great area that was affected, was that it's not just the houses that were blown away, it was the businesses, their ability to create some kind of an economy, their ability to move forward, you know, to eat, to be able to rebuild the housing, feed the families, etc. That's all well and good. If you got someplace where there's a smaller disaster, you can pull from outside sources. This thing hit so hard that it destroyed the economy.
Yeah, and I'll give you a couple of comments on that. The first is definitely that destruction was so massive. And one of the parallels between what happened in Japan and what happened on the Louisiana Gulf Coast, and now has happened again with the BP oil spill, is a bedrock industry, a cultural industry, as I call it, that's very much tied to the culture of the region, which was the seafood industry, fishing and shrimping industry. And in both of those regions, that industry has not only had its infrastructure wiped away, the tsunami obviously destroyed the fishing fleets, just as Katrina's destroyed the fishing fleets in Louisiana. But just as the BP oil spill has damaged the perception of the safety of seafood in along the Gulf Coast, in the north eastern coast of Japan, that same situation, a very rich fishing area, that now there are real concerns. And there are even more perceptive concerns about the safety of that seafood product. So in the interim, between now and the time that that can recover, again, both in a real sense, so that the seafood is actually, you know, totally safe, and most of it is. In fact, we were never within, and this is how large the damage area is, we were never within 70 miles of the nuclear reactor area. But there was still great destruction, and so that it needs to be repaired. And in the interim, there have to be strategies developed for the livelihoods of those folks. One of the things that they're considering in Japan is, again, because of the power outage, there's a tremendous amount of debris that needs to be disposed of. They can't burn it because it's infected with salt water, which creates sulfides, which are hazardous. But if they could use a chemical process to process that waste, create electricity from it, and there are some companies that are looking at doing that, creating jobs for people, and also a very heavily forested area, taking biomass, woody biomass, forest floor waste, selective harvesting of forest for use in generating electricity, which is a tremendous need. That's one of the strategies that we're looking at. To give folks employment, give them opportunities to come back, rebuild, until the core industries can be recovered.
Now, by the way, what's the message in this to the average person?
I think the message is that disasters are going to continue to happen, and we don't need to become numb to them. We need to learn to deal with them. Whether it's man-made or natural, I don't even get into that argument. The fact is that because the world's population has grown, development has grown, because the climate is changing to some extent, you can argue how much, we know that disasters that impact populated areas are increasing and have been increasing, and they're going to continue to happen. So we don't need to think that they're not going to happen. The other side of the coin is we don't need to say, oh, there's nothing we can do, because there are things that we can do. And the Japanese, one thing, Michael, that most people don't realize, because it wasn't covered, was that the earthquake did some damage, but it was minimal compared to the damage the tsunami did. Why? Because the Japanese, because they've had earthquakes in the past, have very stringent building standards. Most of the buildings were not severely damaged by the earthquake. So that's preparedness. And then response and recovery is how do you respond, and then how do you rebuild, and rebuild in a way, reinvest in a way, bring the private sector back in a way that creates sustainable growth in those economies.
And now, by the way, the word preparedness, I think preparedness is an important word. I spent 23 years in the interior of Alaska, and I was through a couple of earthquakes there. But the quakes there, they're very rigid. It's a very different kind of a quake. I'm sorry, I take that back. They're not rigid. They flow. They move. And it's very different from in Los Angeles. I was in a few quakes there where it's very rigid. So what they do in L.A., they build the sway into the building. So that's preparedness. Alaska is a whole different story. There's not that many quote-unquote tall buildings, and the ground is different, so the quake is going to be different. So in each place, there's going to be a different issue that we truly have to look at. The one thing that I would be concerned about with going in for any kind of disaster recovery or economic recovery is running into the government. You know, private sector is one thing, but then you've got government controls, government standards, and that's got to be a very slippery, tricky slope to be able to deal with to get the job done.
Well, and most people that are either in business or in management or even guys out on the floor understand this. You know, there's a government's a two-sided coin. There's the restrictive side that is exactly right, regulations and rules that could impede investment. The other side of the coin, however, is that government can be a powerful partner in investing in the infrastructure, in incentives to mitigate, again, mitigate that risk and help them defray some of those costs through tax incentives, through incentives for hiring workers, and so they can become a powerful partner. And the dichotomy of government is that they really play both of those roles. When they do it well, they play both of those roles in a way that assists and encourages private investment. That's the model that we try to utilize. It's the model we utilized on the Gulf Coast in the Gulf Opportunity Zone Act, wherein we said, yes, you know, we certainly want to make sure that if there's another hurricane, your facility, your plant, your small business isn't blown away. But we're going to help you defray the cost of that. And we're going to give you some incentives that are going to help you. We're going to give you access to financing. We'll guarantee some of the financing to take away some of that risk so that you can reinvest. So, again, it's in how it's approached, Michael, that makes the difference. And the model that wasn't perfect, had some problems, as any large-scale effort like this will, but it worked pretty darn well, the model of the Gulf Opportunity Zone Act, the Louisiana and Mississippi recovery authorities that administered those funds and really brought help to those businesses that were considering reinvesting, the small mom and pop businesses, especially the backbone of any economy, and helping them to be able to reinvest with confidence. That is a model that has worked, and we certainly want it to work in Japan.
David, we're just about out of time. Do you have a website we can find you at?
Absolutely. It's www.dadconsult.com. And
by the way,
I'll be posting
real quick
the photos that I had sent to you on that website, and they can feel free to email me if they have any questions at david@dadconsult.com.
Wonderful. Hey, David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michael. I spent some time in Alaska, and it's a beautiful place. I don't know why you moved back.
Very good. Hey, but thanks a lot. Good night.
Dream lover, where are you? With a love oh so true, and a hand that I can hold to feel you near as I grow old, because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover so I don't have to dream alone. Someday, I don't know how, I hope that she'll hear my plea. Some way, I don't know how, she'll bring her love to me. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Dream lover, until then, I'll go to sleep and dream again. That's the only thing to do, till all my lover's dreams come true. Because I want a girl to call my own. I want a dream lover, so I don't have to dream alone. Please don't make me dream alone. I beg you, don't you make me dream alone. No, no, I don't want to dream alone.
my darling, don't make me dream. Please don't make
me. Welcome back. I'm Michael Ray. You're listening to Thought Provoking Talk on Dresser After Dark. Dr. Bradley Nelson with us. He's the author of The Emotion Coat, internationally renowned speaker, a holistic physician, and a medical intuitive. And again, The Emotion Coat, that's his book, reveals to the world for the first time the devastating damage that trapped emotional energies cause, and at the same time providing the fastest, the simplest, and the most effective method of releasing these energies ever devised, and a method that can be learned and practiced by everyone of any age or any background. Bradley Nelson, hi, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, Michael. It's great to be here.
Oh, thank you so much. The Emotion Code. Are we truly driven by our emotions? Is the outcome of everything we do in our life has to do with that particular emotion that drives it?
Well, you know, it's a fascinating thing to think about emotions and to think about a world in which, if you can imagine a world where there are no emotions and how our existence would just be a dull, gray, boring kind of an existence. There would be no happiness. There would be no misery. There wouldn't be anything. So really, emotions are very critical to our lives. The problem that comes in with emotions is that there are times in our lives where we experience intense negative emotions. We've all been there, you know, where we're feeling anger or resentment or depression or sadness or something. And it's during those times of those intense negative emotions that sometimes the energy of that emotion can become trapped in the body. Now, to understand how this works, and it took me a long time to figure this out, as a holistic physician, I was interested in trying to help my patients get better. So I was always open to new things. And about 22 years ago, I was introduced to this idea that emotions can have something to do with health and can affect the health. And as time went on, it became more and more obvious to me that this is really the elephant in the living room in Western medicine, and that what I call trapped emotions, or these emotional energies that become lodged in the body during these intense emotional events, these are things that are real and that disrupt our health and make us physically sick, that create a tremendous amount of pain for us. I think that 90% of the pain that people have is due wholly or in part to these emotional energies. And I mean, I have seen thousands of cases where people were in acute physical pain, and when the emotional energy is released that was actually creating that pain, the pain is instantly gone. I've seen that more times than I can tell you, and we've got people all over the world now who are learning this very, very simple method that we call the Emotion Code, and they're finding out that they can release their own emotional baggage. You know, we talk about emotional baggage, and we say things like, oh, she's just got a lot of emotional baggage and things like that. But the amazing thing is our emotional baggage is actually a real thing. And to understand how it can possibly be a real thing, you have to look at the body itself. We're living in the 21st century now. We know about quantum physics. We know that if you look at your hand, that hand looks pretty solid to you. But if you look at it in terms of quantum physics, we know that that hand is 99.99999999999% empty space. And really, if you magnify that hand to a point where you'd be looking at an individual atom, if you were to look inside of that atom, you'd see there's really nothing there but these infinitesimally small energies flitting around at the speed of light and lots and lots and lots of empty space. So that's really what we are. Well, we know now that we can measure thoughts electronically, and we can measure emotions too, and it appears that different emotions have different vibrational energies, different frequencies. And so what happens apparently is that when you're feeling an intense negative emotion like anger or depression or whatever, your whole being can begin to vibrate with this new frequency. Now, we don't understand exactly yet how this works, but it appears that sometimes this vibration, this emotional feeling, is just simply too much for the body to process, and so the energy of the emotion becomes actually trapped in the body.
You can actually. Let me hold you up for a minute because there's a prime example with this. Emotions being trapped in the body. Years ago, I used to work with some people occasionally about losing some weight. You know, let's pick a number. They're 300 pounds. You get them down to 250 pounds, you get stuck, and they just could not drop any weight. You'd have to go through what happened in their life. You had to do a little bit of regression to find out what was going on in their life at that particular weight. Once they cleared that, then they would drop some more weight, and then they get stuck again. And then you'd have to clear that. So this trapped emotion, it does. It gets stuck in the body. And it's got to get cleared before the body can move to whatever degree you want the body to for healing.
Yeah, it's really an amazing thing. And what happened with me was as time went on and I saw the devastation that these trapped emotions are creating in people's lives, that it finally became clear to me that I had to get out of my private practice. I needed to write a book. This needed to really go out to the whole world. And so that's what we're doing. And the beauty of this method is that it's so simple, and yet because anybody can learn it. And we have kids even that are doing it. But yet it can be so powerful that sometimes people who learn how to do this can release a trapped emotion usually within about a minute or so. And okay. I've taught seminars around the world on this, and there was a woman who came to one of our seminars in Toronto with her sister. And she said that her sister had migraine headaches for 15 years. She released one trapped emotion from her sister, who had not then after that had a headache for 3 months. And then they came to the seminar. So it is really amazing how much these trapped emotional energies affect us.
Okay, but how do you dump it? I'm not going through the entire thing because realistically, you can't give an audience in 5 minutes or 3 minutes what the entire book, the seminar, or CDs, etc. would do. But let's say, for instance, that here, prime example. I know somebody who was frightened to death of losing things. And one day she realized that fear of losing things went all the way back to when her mom died. Her mom died when she was like 6-7 years old. She lost her mother. Somebody said to her that you were rejected by your mom. She said, no, I can't. How can I be rejected? The opposite of acceptance is rejection. Took her a lot of years to figure out her fears of losing something. She never tied it back to that particular specific time in her life. So are we really dealing with things that happen to us that we unconsciously carry, and an experience that looks like the old thing comes up and you're responding to that emotionally at that moment?
Well, that's exactly how these things operate. For example, there was a young woman who came to me who was having difficulty. She was a court stenographer. She was in training to be a court stenographer. And every time she would try to take the final exam, she would go to pieces and fail. And she had one last shot at it. And so we tested her. We found that she had a trapped emotion that had occurred during the time that her parents were going through a divorce when she was about 8 years old. We released that trapped emotion, and then she took the test and aced it. Another example, I had a patient who came to me. She was a 72-year-old woman. We found that, and how we find these trapped emotions, by the way, is very interesting. You see, we use about maybe 5 to 10% of our intelligence is the conscious mind. But, of course, 90 to 95% of our intelligence is subconscious. And it's in the subconscious mind. Your subconscious mind is an archiving holographic computer. It's tracking everything you've ever done, every moment of your life. And that's where the information is. And so in the book and the videos and so on, we teach a number of different methods, very simple, easy methods, to tune in to that subconscious mind and get answers. And we use muscle testing and different ways of doing that. And anyway, I was working on this woman, this 72-year-old lady, and the first thing that showed up was that she had a trapped emotion of sadness. We have a chart of emotions, and just within seconds you can zero in and figure out what the emotion is, which we did. It was sadness. And so I traced it back, asking her subconscious mind questions and muscle testing her, and it went back 10, 20, 30, 40 years. It went back to 1963. And I thought to myself, well, gee, I wonder if that was about JFK. And so I verbalized that to her, and at the moment, that I did that, and at the same moment I got a strong muscle response from her. That's her subconscious mind saying, yeah, that's what it was about. At that same moment, she bursts into tears, and she's saying, oh, yeah, that affected me so deeply. And then when his son died in the plane crash, you know, JFK Jr., she said it all came back to me all over again, and all she could do for days at that point was cry, you know, when JFK Jr. died. Well, that's an example of how these trapped emotions will make you feel kind of an enhanced emotional response. And then I thought, you know, I wondered, where has this thing been all these years? What has this done to her? And we tested that as well. And it wasn't on the right side of her body. It was on the left side. Because, you see, a trapped emotion is literally a ball of energy from about the size of a baseball to about the size of a cantaloupe. And they will actually lodge somewhere in the physical body. And we were able to figure out where this thing had been all those years. And it was in the area of the left chest. And when we found that, she and I just kind of all of a sudden looked at each other with our mouths dropped open, because 4 years before she'd had that left breast removed because it was malignant, see? And so these are the kinds of things that we're seeing. And we've had people who have been suicidally depressed who have gotten well in a matter of days from having their emotional baggage released, people who are in pain, people who have back pain, neck pain, migraines, knee pain, elbow pain, you name it, people who have malfunction with their organs, or people who have been diagnosed with various diseases. Now, I always tell people the emotion code is not any kind of a cure for any kind of a disease. What we try to do is just remove the emotional baggage, and then the body is able to function better.
Now, by the way, what you're dealing with is an unconscious activation of a memory to a recognizable association or an experience, and it's a buried memory. And I think the greatest example of that, Brad, would be go to a movie. You know, you got trained, you got skilled actors and actresses on that screen. Part of that learned skill is knowing what they do and what they say is going to trigger a specific emotion. You know, they're reading from a script. You know it's not real, and they're pulling every emotion out of you. You're crying, you're in love, you're frightened, you're angry, because in that moment, they're not doing it, you are. And I think it really lies into this, it lies from the same place of the foundation of where it is. It's the same thing you're talking about. It's that triggering of something, the recognition of something within you that triggers a reaction. But sometimes you don't recognize it, and it comes out in all kinds of different ways in your life.
Well, the beauty of the emotion code, and you're absolutely right, the beauty of the emotion code is that by accessing the information that's in the subconscious mind, we're able to remove emotional baggage that people have inherited from their ancestors, or that they picked up in the womb or when they were a young child, that people have no conscious knowledge of, and yet it's affecting them in the present day. So
sure.
That's kind of an overview of it.
Yeah, it's affecting them. Like, you walk into the, if you're married, you walk into the room, your wife smiles at you a certain way. Well, maybe 40 years ago, somebody smiled at you the same way that smacked you in the nose. And what you're going to get is the same response. And it has nothing to do with her. It has to do with what happened in the past, and we are not recognizing the two. And I think what you're doing is brilliant.
Well, yes, and the beauty of it is when we find that emotion and we release that, then that automatic response that people normally have, that's gone. And people say, like, for example, people will say things like, you know, you released that trapped emotion and my back's better, but also I'm not angry anymore. I used to have a hair trigger temper. Where did that go? That type of thing. So.
Sure. Oh, absolutely. No question about it. Now, by the way, do you have a website that we can find you and the book and all of your work?
Yeah, actually, we have a website. It's at healerslibrary.com, healerslibrary.com. And if you go to that website and you add /global behind that, all lowercase, we have a special offer for people that they can take a look at and actually get the Emotion Code book for free.
Wonderful. I think that's a great idea. Hey, Brad Nelson, thank you so much for joining us again. The book is The Emotion Code, and great work. And again, thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Take care. Good night.
You too. Bye. Could I trade for this? And just think, I get paid for this.
Good night, ladies and gentlemen, and God bless.